Welcome to the first chapter and synopsis of Halion Eon by Dave Norman. Copyright 2020, David G. Norman. All rights reserved. Samples from this first chapter of Halion Eon may be freely quoted, provided they are each clearly credited to the author. For other permission requests, email eon@halion.com. The full Halion Eon novel is available in printed book form, ISBN 978-0995606005, or in ebook form, ISBN 978-0995606012. Published in the United Kingdom by Halion Limited. www.halion.com. Halion is a UK registered trademark of David G. Norman. Author foreword. Studies of ancient history, mythology, legend and religion reveal a myriad strange stories of fantastical events, sacred places, and amazing objects of wonder. Many show surprising similarities across diverse regions and cultures, perhaps hinting at common cause or provenance in ages even further past. In those ancient times, such wonders were often attributed to the mysterious moves of godly intent. Or, maybe, just a magic. Yet mankind's ever greater grasp of universal truth may now shed new scientific light on some of those oddities of old. Halion Eon launches a novel series that weaves a twisting thread through a selected sample of those stories. Some may once have held more truth than their mystical status implies. Others may hide far deeper meaning than is, at first, apparent. Above all, just a few global events, grounded in reality, may have sparked a vast swathe of subsequent myths and mysteries within the imagination of mankind. The religious references and reinterpretation in this series are never intended to offend, but rather to suggest means by which many wondrously worded but oft-dismissed theological themes may, perhaps, be reconciled with current or future physical science. Who can say which keys of conjecture will, ultimately, open the locked safe of truth? After all, what we currently consider to be proven scientific fact may, someday, be cast as merely the quaint musings of misguided belief. This quest to crystallize the chaos of subconscious creativity into a cohesive story has spawned several supposedly original concepts that were subsequently revealed to be rooted in hidden historic reality or ancient mythology. So, please conduct your own research into and beyond the scenarios and snippets of science upon these pages. You may discover whole new worlds of wonder and wisdom waiting within. Predominantly probing prehistory, this first novel lays the foundation for later works that will, ultimately, take the tale forward into far distant times ahead. This first chapter of that novel launches the outermost of several nested story arcs. All told, the Halion Pentalogy will encompass over 10 billion years of past, present, and potential future. So, I wish you well on this alternative journey through what may have been a series of key moments in our galactic and human history. You really never know. And please don't ever forget, it's all just a work of fiction. This novel follows Interstellar Engel, Syntax 112.04. Engel's humanized form is being guided towards full compliance. It still has some way yet to go. Although it is already, commendably, Engel-ish. Chapter 1. New Moon. 4.5 billion years ago, in the young solar system. It was truly a sight worthy of those who would look up at the night sky in wonder. Yet no eyes would widen in awestruck terror at their impending demise. Nor would a single soul be sacrificed to the spectacle soon to be unleashed upon this planet. For only the most primitive hadronic life entities would grace its about-to-be-renewed surface in the next 3 billion years. This was a promising new world. One in a million of a trillion in the galaxy, it already offered two of the primary properties needed to one day nurture advanced life. Its orbit was reasonably circular, avoiding extremes of temperature swings over the course of each year. Furthermore, that orbit lay well within the habitable zone of its young and relatively stable star, neither too near to its searing stellar heat, nor too far out into the frigid void of space. When the frenetic formation of this system's planets finally abated, the universal solvent of life, liquid water, would be free to flow within the streams, rivers, lakes, seas and oceans that would carve aqueous character into its surface scenery and subterranean caverns. This was, indeed, a good start. But three basic improvements would far better suit it to the successful evolution of life over geological time. To start with, it needed to grow. Although already the largest rocky planet in its system, additional mass would give its surface gravity a vital boost that would tighten its gravitational grip upon the tenuous atmospheric gases that could one day rain water upon the land, bring the breath of fresh air to surface life and shield its reproductive frenzy from the ravages of stellar radiation. Atmospheric stability would greatly strengthen the long-term prospects of any future surface biosphere. Sadly, too many promising but less massive planets across the galaxy had vented potentially protective and life-sustaining atmospheres to their surfaces. Only for the energetic winds of their stellar hosts to blast those gases, slowly but surely, away into the depths of space. Along with any chance of such worlds ever hosting life that would look up at the night sky in wonder. Oddly, this world's hopes would be heightened by a heavy heart. It craved a massive and mostly molten iron core, beneath a cooler, rocky mantle, raising steep thermal gradients across which colossal core convection currents could surge and twist into vast vortices around its axial spin. That whirling electromagnetic dynamo would cast immense magnetic fields up through the surface and far into space beyond, a global magnetosphere, able to shield delicate new life from the sterilizing wrath of stellar winds and coronal mass, ejected by the fitful convulsions of its star. A stable atmosphere and an extensive magnetosphere would work together to promote this planet's prolonged potential for synthesizing and sustaining primitive life. But, for any nascent biology to boom over truly evolutionary ages, its birth world also needed the beneficial seasonal soothing of an axial stabilizer. Left alone, the spin axis of even a sizable planet could tilt and topple erratically over geological time, driven by the gyroscopic churning of its internal materials and gravitational perturbations instilled by its orbital neighbors. Such chronic axial chaos would severely constrain the subsequent evolution of latent life, with seasons wandering wildly amid dramatic and unpredictable climatic changes. And the best way for a planet to gain eternal spin stability would be to share its stellar orbit with the calming gravitational tug of a single, substantial, natural satellite. To achieve its promising potential to bring forth and foster advanced life, this young planet desperately needed a moon. Yet the most unnatural of circumstances were about to confer mass, magnetosphere and moon upon this planet, all at once. A cascading chain of events, triggered centuries ago, would soon culminate in a cataclysm that would transform its geological nature to benefit biological nature. Looming ever larger, an orbital companion was on a closing course to a cosmic collision, akin to billions already witnessed by their young star. Although the single most spectacular of those to follow, the coming catastrophe would complete just the first of several stages, in a uniquely complex and consciously creative coalescence of worlds. One whose outcome was deemed critical to the Halian heritage of the entire galaxy. So, no relic of random motion had been risked in setting the scene for this dynamically destructive dance to the orchestral overtones of orbital mechanics. For this impending impact had been driven, not by destiny, but by design. And it would not be the last. Chapter 1.1 Lairs of Lagrange. As it swung along its orbit around a young sun, the planet one day to be called Earth was not alone. The twin agents of its coming transformation into a blue world of life had long been in place, as loyal planetary neighbors. for its accretion from the tenuous mix of gas and dust in this new star's inner circumstellar disk had not happened in isolation. The past 50 million years or so had seen a frenzy of planetary formation across the entire solar system. Far out in the frozen depths of space, countless billions of prospective new worlds had been accreted from chaos, as powerful but short-range electrostatic and weak but far-reaching gravitational forces forged dusty grains and icy crystals into ever bulkier bodies, in a creative destructive cycle of aggregation and collision. Throughout its innermost realms, innumerable rocky protoplanets had grown within orbits both nearer to and further from their star than the prospective Earth. More distant still, colder and thicker bands of ice and dusty debris had quickly spawned far larger planetary cores, able to attract and retain deep and dense atmospheres of primordial gas. The immense gravitational grasp of the solar system's largest planet, the mighty gas giant, Jupiter, would someday direly threaten the orbital stability of the inner planets, but it would ultimately come to protect its rocky siblings from later bombardment by sweeping up much of the debris left over from the turmoil of their collective birth. Yet the proto-Earth had already conjured a rather neat, gravitational debris-gathering trick of its very own. Of nature's so-called fundamental forces, gravity laid its ever-attractive qualities most clearly open to observation on the grandest scales. Easing off its far-reaching tug between two masses, with the square of their separation, its effect often emerged in closed cosmic curves, along which gravitationally bound bodies would orbit each other in eternal embrace. Pairs of such partners would trace their perpetual paths along more or less eccentric ellipses around their common center of mass, a barycentric point which, for bodies of vastly different scales, such as a planet and its star or a moon, would often rest deep within the more massive of the two. Those gazing upon heaven's gyrations would gasp at the sheer geometric grace garnered from the formerly random motions of matter, gripped by the remotely forceful grasp of gravity. Yet its seemingly simple laws concealed some surprisingly counterintuitive consequences that could turn a cozy company of two into a crowd of three, four, or even more. Earth's broadly circular solar orbit followed those of its more fortunate planetary peers across the galaxy. Likewise, as for the orbit of any body around an object more than about 25 times its mass, its annual path harbored two hidden, secret gardens. These invisible realms could each turn gravity's grasp to nurturing the germination of new planetary growth from the cosmic seed still strewn across the solar system. Centered, 60 degrees, one-sixth of its orbit, ahead of Earth, lay a large swathe of space where its gravity conspired with that of the Sun to create a strangely stable and subtly seductive gravitational trap. One, mirrored by an identical region, centered, 60 degrees, behind Earth, along its orbit. The interplay between orbital mechanics and orbiting bodies transformed these twin peaks of gravitational potential into gently grasping pits, towards which matter might appear to fall. Each could collect and keep a fair fraction of the still growing Earth's mass in dynamically stable orbital equilibrium. And these were two layers, into which much of their fill of the inner solar system's birth debris had long since been lured. Billions of years hence, the human beneficiaries of these gravitational quirks would name these two regions, along with three others, after the mathematician Lagrange. For the Sun proto-Earth system, the first three Lagrangian points lay along the line passing through both bodies. As if balancing their opposing gravitational pulls, the first Lagrangian point, L1, rested 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, towards the Sun. Somewhat less intuitively, L2 lay roughly the same distance further from the Sun, with L3 mirroring Earth's location on the far side of the Sun. For all their homely qualities, though, these unstable Lagrangian points would ultimately fail as long-term traps of natural material. Any drift away from them would draw a body further out still into free solar orbit. Only around the two Lagrangian points sharing Earth's orbit, L4 and L5, would the curving Coriolis effect gently guide any wandering worldlets back towards their confines. So, as eternally stable cradles for accretive body building, these twin cosmic corrals had long since coaxed gravity to grasp their shares of grit, and grow from it too, wrecking ball worlds. Patiently awaiting their cues in opposite orbital wings, these planetesimal stars of grandest ballet were both now poised to pirouette, in turn, onto center stage. There, each to play their part in an apocalyptic pas de deux. Mother of the Sun, Thea of many names, for your sake men honor gold as more powerful than anything else, and through the value you bestow on them, O Queen, ships contending on the sea and yoke teams of horses in swift whirling contests, become marvels. The Fifth Isthmian Ode of Pindar. 2 months ahead of Earth, along its orbit, at L4, lay Thea. By now packing almost 6% of Earth's mass, this substantial new world was already pushing the limit of its welcome within this protoplanetary creche. Sooner or later, it would be tempted out into its own orbit, by gravitational tugs from the immense bulk of Jupiter. Ably assisted by attractive impulses from the still-growing planet Venus, as it lapped its larger neighbor from the next orbit inward towards the Sun. Should that happen, Theia's natural path would likely trace a long series of strangely, horseshoe-shaped orbits, relative to Earth, as it repeatedly approached, recoiled from, returned towards and finally, fatally, impacted upon its parent planet. Such an event would, indeed, serve to supplement Earth's mass down to its very core. The ultimate composition of a newly forming body varied broadly with orbital distance from its star. So, formed from the same primordial debris as Earth, Theia shared much of its elemental makeup, including a substantial, nickel-iron nucleus. However, the uncontrolled dumping of Theia's mass, with effectively random impact location, incident angle and velocity would not likely guarantee the new Earth its much-desired magnetosphere. Nor, for that matter, its vital new moon. Theia's orbital eviction and ultimate collision certainly needed to happen someday soon. Not least, to remove its clear and present threat to any future sparks of earthly life. But, to guarantee the rise of Gaia, the fall of Theia demanded a degree of designed direction, truly worthy of those who might, one day, look up at their night sky in wonder.
Chapter 1.2 Moonmaker.
Had the eyes of any biological intellect ever witnessed this enigmatic entity in their night sky, they would surely have drawn their owner's mind to the outer limits of both wonder and confusion. Yet, its billion-year tour of the galaxy had not once cast its elusive light upon even the most primitive lifeform. For its duties drew it to the dusty disks of destructive creation around only newborn stars. Furthermore, its ghostly presence would barely register upon purely light-sensitive eyes, and then only as a dark and nonsensically shifting, geometric shadow. Not that its reluctance to reflect or transmit light would have concealed its path among this boulder-strewn birthplace of planetary bodies. Its steady passage, against the stellar background of deep space, would have seemed blindingly obvious to any persistent onlooker. For it had long since swept completely clear of debris, a band either side of its own original orbit around the infant sun. And what this optically opted-out object lacked in luminosity, it could outweigh a trillion times over, by the artificially amplified power of its sheer gravitational presence. By any normal measure, its strangely dynamic physical form would seem to span less than 2 kilometers. Yet the constraints of conventional size would fit loosely indeed, upon the ethereal extent of an object that could shrink and stretch the sinews of space to suit its own purpose. With the span of even the most voluminous bodies dwarfed to insignificance against the infinite scale of space, it would soon show that size matters far less than substance. This interstellar nomad needed to throw its weight around the galaxy, from one stellar birth to another, in time to imbue life-bearing stability amid sterile cosmic chaos. A task that demanded a universally unique form of agility, that no device of merely three-dimensional design could conceivably deliver. During each multi-millennial transit from one stellar birth to the next, this multi-dimensional midwife would expose only a relatively modest mass of barely 3 million tons. Although certainly demanding prodigious propulsive power, the transgalactic movement of such mass, at near light speeds, was perfectly possible with its billion-year-old technology. That had not been the weighty problem with which its ancient creators had for so long wrestled, at first without success, to ultimately solve. It was not the motion, but the magnitude of its mass over which this object needed unnatural mastery. Within the colliding carnage of each new planetary crash, only one force could gently but firmly coax the creative coalescence of so many sterile bodies into a few able to offer eternal homes for life. The same fundamental force that had given the newborn sun's outer bulk the unbearable weight to crush its core into fusion. The force of gravity. Although immense by any sentient standard, no mere 3 megaton mass could project anywhere near enough gravitational pull to perturb the course of a significant planetesimal. So, this ancient object had audaciously amplified its culminating act of attraction by drawing down a vast reserve of eternally missing mass. It had rightly reclaimed, with interest, some of the essence of gravity that had long been leaking its potency from the realm of natural three-dimensional space into an altogether higher place. One where neither the sun nor any star had ever sought to shine. As future seekers of scientific truth across the galaxy strove to understand nature's so-called fundamental forces, they would often find a full theory of gravity to be the most elusive of all. As it had once been, even to the creators of the object, now so unnaturally usurping its power. Somehow remarkably similar across species, early theories of gravity represented its effects well enough to predict planetary paths, using laws of motion distilled from the astronomical observations of sharp eyes and the intellectual inspiration of equally sharp minds. Even then, those first interpretations would soon be undermined by what seemed the subtly errant paths of planets seen passing through the inner gravitational fields of their stars, as often first noticed during stellar eclipses, by the large natural satellites their home planets nearly all seem to have in common. The relativistic theories eventually proposed, and then proven, to precisely predict these pesky orbital perturbations would provide a far more profound insight into the fundamental nature of gravity. One which ceased even to consider it to be a genuine force at all. Rather, gravity could be recast as merely consequent to the geometric curvature of four-dimensional space-time, by energy and momentum guiding massive bodies along mutually attractive paths, as if by their purely forward motion over a mass-pitted membrane. Yet, even as these insights into reality deepened, so did the equally profound paradoxes to which the proponents of ever-advancing science would soon be pointing. Often first to emerge from new insight into the infinitesimally small were the quantum theories. Their powerful and precise predictions would propose ethereal graviton virtual particles to constitute a gravitational field, much as the light-bearing photon did for its electromagnetic counterpart. But just how could the infinitesimal scale of subatomic particles conceptually enclose the infinite scale of curved spacetime? Most species would struggle, long and hard, to unify theories that were each immensely successful on their own scales into a grand theory of, well, everything. Yet that there was, indeed, room, in reality for such apparently disparate ideas, would testify to the existence of higher realms of space, across which those theories would ultimately unite. However it worked at root, gravity was undeniably a true power player at the grandest scales of the universe. To its attractive charm fell the motions of mighty galactic superclusters over immense spatial spans. But the gravitational quality empowering the alien object, now completing its first maneuver in a million years, was not one of might, but of meekness. Despite its pan-universal grasp, gravity outwardly appeared orders of magnitude weaker than its electromagnetic, or so-called strong and weak nuclear force counterparts. Yet it was to the very cause of this strange cosmic conundrum that this device owed its own superlative strength. Over 9 billion years had passed since one time and three spatial dimensions had boldly burst forth from a singular point of birth. Their initial freedom to inflate had shown gravity's restraint, in binding newborn matter and energy around the casual curves of four-dimensional spacetime. Indeed, like a baby buttock-slapping midwife, gravity had actually given the universe a sharp repulsive kick to get it going. As if in gratitude for its benign inflationary boost at birth, nature had then gifted gravity an exclusive grasp upon the far tighter curvature of higher spatial dimensions, into which elusive realms the device had been granted access by its creators, and from which it had just gratefully replenished its reserves of gravitational grapple force. For 1,000 millennia, the object had held a stable solar orbit, midway between those of the budding Earth and its next outermost planetary neighbor, Mars. It had patiently monitored the ongoing formation of both planetary protégés, amid the maelstrom of gravitational interactions and catastrophic collisions still carving the unique character of this complex system. So, it had not made its recent inward move towards the ultimate planetary targets of its attention until it was fully satisfied that another potential future problem had been permanently put to rest. Developing, far out beyond Earth's orbit, was another interplanetary interplay. A gravitational game of gaseous giants, of a type that had spelt ultimate doom to many a planetary parade's life-bearing prospects. But which, if properly played out, would ultimately serve to secure Earth's future protection and help to make it a must-inhabit world. Far too many newborn gas giants had grown swiftly by sweeping up vast swathes of their stellar system's densest ice and dusty debris, only to then descend, in destructive spirals, from the frigid zones of their formation, towards, and even into, the inner realms of rockier planets. In doing so, their immense gravitational pulls had plunged those puny sibling planets into dire peril, often disrupting their orbits into highly eccentric and lifeless ellipses, smashing doomed bodies together, dumping them into their star, or slinging them entirely out of their planetary system, to eventually freeze solid in the dark depths of interstellar space. Had such a scenario been seen to have started here, the object would have devoted its attention to disarming its destructive outcome. At least, as best it could. Sadly, the entity had been forced to leave far too many failing planetary systems to their fate. Even its pan-dimensionally amplified powers of attraction had often been dwarfed by the unstoppable inward incursions of the mighty super-Jupiter gas giants lurking therein. But, in this system, it had at last sensed a source of future hope. One set to eventually restrain what would still yet become a visibly clear and present danger. Alarmingly, the device's first deep scan, on approaching this system, had found the predicted future orbit of Jupiter to be threatening the realm of the four sizable rocky inner planets and their innumerable planetesimal companions. Formed first, and fast, from the densest dust and icy debris, Jupiter's immense natural gravity would someday stunt the future growth of Mars by disrupting its nearby debris bands into what would become two parallel populations of inwardly rocky and outwardly icy asteroids. Indeed, in its roving role as an interstellar sleuth, the device had even uncovered circumstellar evidence of past planicide. Although far from proven guilty as charged, Jupiter may already have long since destroyed a first generation of supersized inner rocky planets, spawning the Earth and its companions from their recycled wreckage. Yet the object's deeper orbital simulations had also discovered a potential source of planetary salvation, waiting in the wings. A calming influence, poised to step in and restore ultimate stability to a solar system over which anarchy would once have threatened to reign. As ever, the device's recent decision to forge ahead with the 3-into-2 accretion of Earth's orbital occupants had been taken at considerable risk. Its billion-year forecasts of future planetary orbits would prove accurate in 9 of 10 systems. But each failure of foresight could doom a potentially life-bearing system to eternal sterility. It was powerless to prevent the catastrophic carnage that would be cast upon some of its past protégés by errant superplanets. But, perhaps, a few more promising candidate systems could have been picked out for protection, given true perfection of prediction. Sadly, such future certainty was, in principle, beyond the reach of any entity due to the inherently chaotic character of circumstellar disk evolution. No amount of sensory ability or prodigious computing power could predict the precise path of a system's birth material from dusty debris to pristine planets. Indeed, the future orbits even of long-formed major bodies would often prove surprisingly dynamic until the entire system had settled down, maybe a billion or more years beyond its birth. Even then, the most mature and stable of planetary systems could still be twisted into orbital knots by the gravitational perturbations of just a single, passing, star. So, it was with long and hard-enforced caution that the device had predicted the eventual restraint of Jupiter's rampage by the calming influence of its next outward neighbor. The second largest of the solar system's gas giants. Jupiter's smaller yet still mighty sibling, Saturn. Not even Saturn's beautifully bloated bulk could directly drag its far more massive counterpart away from playing planetary pucks with their inner siblings. Instead, its gravity would apply subtle but systematic outward tugs, as its own, still changing orbital period, passed through a series of resonances with that of Jupiter. The wonder was that such gentle but persistent gravitational persuasion could imbue the orbits of both gas giants with enough stability to see them through this system's birth throes. The details of this prediction were immensely complex and still worryingly prone to the whims of chaotic uncertainty. But the device had seen many variations of this Saturnian savior scenario in other systems, most of which had, indeed, survived intact. So far, at least. Almost all long since departed on a trans-universal quest, and already over half a billion light-years beyond the galactic bounds, the creators of the device had still longer ago freed their collective mind from the constraints of syntactic language. Only in the course of a few, brief contacts, with far inferior sentients, had they condescended even to a hint of conventional communication. Within the last ever message of which, they had at least deigned to divulge two terse but onwardly communicable terms for the wondrous bearer of their parting gift to the galaxy. That act of generosity promised, potentially, several thousand life-supporting planets. The awesome device tasked to deliver them was, apparently, known formally to its creators purely in conceptual thought, only very loosely approximated in linguistic terms as the accreta. So it was that the galaxy's first and never-to-be-surpassed planetary-scale mass accretion device had, with renewed confidence, turned its attractive attention to another creative coalescence of multiple worlds into a single planet-moon pair. Upon completion of which, it would yet again justify the rather less formal but equally apt alternative title, once coined by its creators. As the accreta set upon its first orbital shift in a million years, the eight, ethereal, cubic faces of its four-dimensional, tesseract hypersurface each seemed to entwine the black bounds of their own space into something, somehow, beyond. The eerily elusive shape that the accreta had set in motion towards Earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep shadow cast by its ghostly projection onto the plane of merely three-dimensional space. So, the spirit of the accreta moved upon the face of the waters, upon an interplanetary ocean of gravitational waves, across which it now set sail, on a quest to grant the nascent Earth a 300 billion billion ton boost of gas-gripping mass. This would be a geological gift of the grandest proportions, from the heart of which would someday spring forth the core-churning birth stirrings of a life-shielding magnetosphere, and which would benignly bind Earth to the latest in a long line of the axially calming cosmic companions that had so creatively marked the masterful motions of the Moon Maker. Chapter 1.3. Graviton Flux. Just decades had passed since the planetary accreta's initial orbital update. Not only had it left its original parking orbit, midway between Earth and Mars, it had also moved inward to carefully cross the shared path of the three bodies to which its attention was now dedicated. Dutifully sensing, as it went, the subtle orbital drag still being induced upon them by dusty debris and fitfully gusting solar winds. Settling into a new orbit within that of Earth and, this time, midway out from Venus, It had lain in waiting contemplation of the perfect timing for its first fateful perturbation pulse. That short day of future earthly deliverance, through apparent doom, had dawned less than 60 years later. Rounding its faster inner track, the accreta had once more reached the radius vector sweeping from the center of the sun, out to Theia. But, this time around, that imaginary line had also hosted, on its still faster sunward orbital passage, the planetary partner in the accreta's plan. A suitably massive anchor, against which its forthcoming attractive perturbation would very soon be perpetrated. The still red glowing globe of the young planet Venus. Slowly spiraling around L4, 60 degrees ahead of Earth along their common orbit, Theia had been more casually accreting matter from much the same primordial pool, boasting barely 6% of Earth's mass. Even so, at almost 40% of its diameter, Theia would someday cast a short-lived, but scarily sinister shadow upon the face of its planetary peer. At that time spanning less than 12,000 kilometers, the still-growing proto-Earth would behold the approach of a behemoth, almost 4,600 kilometers across. But, not until Theia could, at last, be persuaded to leave its Lagrangian lair. The critical moment of four-body syzygy had arrived. For just a few seconds, the accreta straddled the same sufficiently straight line through three-dimensional space as the Sun, Venus, and Theia. Given its recent measurement of the orbital debris drag on its target, and the precise gravitational jolt it was about to generate, it had honed to perfection its exquisitely detailed set of orbital simulations. So, as it primed its powers for that first perturbation pulse, the accreta once again pondered the predicted endpoint of Theia's future path. And the accreta saw that it was good. 50 million and more years of planet-making mayhem had passed, since the ignition of nuclear fusion at its core had conferred truly stellar status upon the Sun. Yet the briefest blink, of barely 17 seconds, would commence the orbital reconstruction of the entire inner solar system, as its gravitational landscape lay open to the accreta's transdimensional grasp upon gravitons gleaned from a higher place. Its unique ability to down-dimension gravity's force-carrying bosons gave the accreta the effective mass boost to actually make its influence upon planetary-scale objects felt. That attractive influence would now be applied between two bodies, as if by a gravitational winch. The intent was to imbue the first of a few brief but intense pulses of fatal attraction upon the target of its attention, Theia, in one direction. Balanced against the planetary anchor of Venus, in the other. Throughout those 17 seconds of its first perturbation pulse, a truly prodigious graviton flux flowed down through the accreta, from the fourth spatial dimension and beyond. Flooding from opposite cubic facets of the accreta's projection onto three-dimensional space, this immense graviton flux induced an intense local distortion of spacetime. Although common of forceful cause, that flux had not formed one of the all-round gravity wells, so often pressed into spacetime by the natural masses of astronomical bodies. Instead, directed through what advanced species would someday dub a G-lens, this was a focused distortion, directed primarily along a linear region through, and to either side of the accreta, as a pair of transient, if rapidly deepening gravitational rifts. One aimed inward, towards Venus, the other surging out, towards Theia. Within just the first few seconds of the perturbation pulse, each of these seismic spacetime splits had delved many orders of magnitude deeper than that imprinted by the accreta's own merely megaton-scale mass. Such had been the efficiency of its graviton drawdown from higher dimensional realms, that it had momentarily multiplied its mass presence by a factor of some 2 billion trillion. Along the axis of each linear rift, a broad gravitational beam had boosted the accreta's interplanetary pulling power, to mimic that of a body three times the mass of the Sun. Traveling at light speed, it took little more than a minute for the leading edge of each gravitational rift to propagate out to its target, either side of the accreta. Well before which, the 17 seconds of perturbation pulse had ended, leaving each rift's trailing edge racing outward, behind the 5-million-kilometer-long abyss of a deep spacetime fissure. Fissures, into which both Venus and Theia were each about to fall. Seconds later, both planet and planetesimal were simultaneously struck by their own spacetime equivalent of a shore-crashing tsunami. Yet, these were waves from which there would be no escape to high ground. For each gravitational trough was traveling, at light speed, almost 300,000 kilometers per second. Furthermore, like any tsunami triggered by a seismic seafloor slump, the first warning sign would be a sudden surge of suction towards its source. As the leading edges of the focused gravitational beams washed over both objects, each was dealt a sharp and irresistibly attractive jolt towards its creator. Yet, little sense of acceleration would be felt by either, as each was merely following its natural path through the space so sharply and suddenly curved by the intense graviton flux. Even so, both bodies had been deeply moved by these twin shocks to the solar system's status quo, the consequences of which would ripple down through space-time for billions of years to come. The ultimate results of those ripples were supremely sensitive to the new initial conditions that their perpetrator had just imbued. Even the tiniest divergence from its plan could spell doom to Earth's life-bearing prospects and the dashing of the accretor's hopes for this entire stellar system. So, it next meticulously measured the match of Theia's new orbital motion against that it had so carefully simulated. And the accretor saw that it was good. Not only had this single momentous event commenced the countdown to Earth's transformation into a world worthy of life, but it had also addressed another significant risk from the register of threats to that life. For both the strength and the timing of the perturbation pulse had been carefully chosen to boost the stability of the Sun's innermost offspring. It had left Venus with a path around the Sun, slightly more circular than it had been before, indeed, with the least eccentric orbit of any planet in the solar system. Future perturbations by other bodies would periodically change such factors, but this one tweak would at least reduce the effect of any future orbital interactions between Venus and Earth. However, it was the reaction of Theia's orbital path to the pulse that had become critical. Like those of Venus, Theia's 17 seconds of gravitational freefall into the accretor's spacetime fissure had barely changed its velocity along its orbit around the Sun, as this first pull on both bodies had been across their directions of motion. What it had done, though, was to nudge Theia into an orbit now marginally more eccentric than Earth's, one which left Theia lingering around the point of forever leaving its Lagrangian lair. With the first of several planned perturbation pulses propagated, the accretor had one more vital check to make before settling in to await its next raid on the hidden graviton wealth of higher dimensions. The creation of a new moon for Earth would demand that Theia be impacted not only within a precisely constrained approach path and velocity, but also, at least until the very last moment, with Theia still in one piece. After the physical shock of falling into such a deep gravitational rift, the continued structural integrity of any body could never be assumed. The accretor had seen several structurally unsound impactors, summarily shattered by the sheer tidal stresses induced as its supercharged gravitational wave swept through their bodies. Although such a messy mass could still be guided to its target, the effect of its distribution upon impact would be far less predictable. A fragmented impactor's mass would indeed be delivered. But the much-needed angular momentum and moon matter ejection plume might not. To assuage its anxiety, the accretor then set to scanning the inner integrity of the object it had so brutally shocked away from its natural course. From halfway to Venus, it brought a billion years of body-shifting experience and interstellar insight to bear upon sensing the state of Theia's tidally stressed internal structure. And the accretor saw that it was good. So ended the first day in the genesis of the Earth and its moon. The critical die had been cast in a gravitational game of throws, which would culminate, five geologically brief centuries hence, in the formation of an arena fit to foster an enduring firestorm of future evolution. A 500-year blink of geology set to spur a 5-billion-year blaze of biology. Over the next half millennium, three more perturbations of Theia would be administered and assessed by an accretor growing ever more confident of this planetary system's prognosis for life. Each new pulse aligned Venus and Theia either side of the accretor, but with the Sun now well off axis, so subtly shifting Theia's orbital velocity, and, slowly but steadily, spiraling it ever further out from its birthplace. Yet, only as the accretor punched forth its final and most powerfully perturbing pulse, did the curving clutch of the Coriolis effect finally release its grasp upon Theia's orbital fate. Torn away from the stable cradle of Earl 4, Theia could at last claim freedom to cruise away from its childhood creche and follow its own orbital trajectory around the Sun. Albeit, upon a path which would soon intersect that of Earth. Chapter 1.4 Theia Fall. It was truly a sight worthy of those who would look up at the night sky in wonder. Yet, no sentient skywatcher would stare up in awe from the violently volcanic and acridly atmospheric surface of this young Earth. Looming large above the hellish horizons of which, Theia's visual transformation from bright but distant dot of light to broadening black disk of descending doom was close to its catastrophic culmination. Theia had long held office as the High Herald of Earthly Dawn. From its stable cradle, 60 degrees ahead of Earth, along its orbit, it had served as the ever-shining morning star. Strangely static relative to the Sun, this heavenly beacon had always risen 1/6 of a day ahead of its light. But the mother of the morning sun, the maternal maker of the dawn, had at last been seduced away from her watchpost and was irresistibly inbound towards the dramatic delivery of her final birth. Precisely on the velocity, and only 3 kilometers off the track laid by the accretor almost 5 centuries earlier, Theia was in the final phase of its fall to Earth. From its projected point of fatal first contact, its beautiful but forebodingly magma-blooded bulk filled, in deep silhouette, a swathe of sky over 30 degrees across. Cast ahead in ever-sharpening relief, along its sunward approach path, Theia's immense shadow swept in silence across the face of the Earth, ominously swelling by the second. Although still several thousand kilometers apart, the union of Theia and Earth had, in one very real sense, already started. Shaped in isolation into seemingly solid spheres, by their own internal gravity, both bodies were really no more than crispy shells of thin crust, around massive molten mantles and cores contained therein. Such fragility suited objects freely following their own stellar orbits, but both bodies were now bathing ever deeper in each other's gravity. And the nearer, closing face of Theia was feeling Earth's gravitational pull, far more strongly than its trailing side. Feebly resisted by its internal structural strength, Theia's formerly spherical shape was simultaneously slimming and stretching, under the sheer tidal stress of Earth's much greater gravity. Ever more visibly bereft of its billiard ball body curves, Theia's leading and trailing faces were ballooning, respectively, forward and backward, along its path of descent. Suddenly unable to ignore Earth's incessant call to closure, the fractally fractured slopes of each bulge blossomed, as a web of rose-red magmatic plumes exploded through a crazed maze of immense crustal cracks. Such was the power of gravity's tidal pull between two bodies of greatly different masses, that even humans would, one day, witness the wrathful yet wondrous effect of such a close encounter. Although, by then, long since retired from playing havoc upon its sibling inner planets, Jupiter would be seen to inflict its gravitational ire upon an errant comet, caught passing within what would then be termed its Roche radius. Summarily torn asunder by the same gravitational tidal stresses now distorting Theia, the doomed debris of comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 would be drawn out into a glorious string of pearls, gracefully adorning one last Jovian orbit. Then, each piece would plunge, in turn, to dramatically depicted destruction, on darkly pock-marking penetration of Jupiter's upper atmospheric clouds. The accretor's plan for Theia's impending demise also demanded its penetration deep into the body of its destructor. Not only would Theia soon donate the bulk of its nickel-iron heart to bolster Earth's own, but it would also impart some of its carefully controlled linear momentum towards boosting the angular momentum of the entire planet. That extra spin momentum would manifest as a step rise in Earth's rate of rotation, which, in turn, would eventually kickstart the first life-preserving magnetospheric motions deep within its newly massive core. Yet, important as Earth's new spin rate was to the plan, the bulk of Theia's momentum would instead be turned to throwing an altogether more magnificent and messy party, literally, out of this world. For as it ploughed sidelong into its molten mantle, the shattered bulk of Theia's former body would propel many moon masses of earthly magma onto an ascent path bound for space. Well, that was the plan, anyway. After a billion years and more in the business, the accretor knew, only too well, that the making of moons and magnetospheres was no mere matter of merging masses. What really mattered was the manner in which those masses met each other and mixed. Not to mention, sending some of that mixture back out into a stable orbit to serve as a substantial new moon. Humans would one day hail Earth's thermally benign orbital range around the Sun as a planetary, Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, and not too cold. The coming accretion, though, was akin to throwing Mummy Bear's piping hot porridge into Daddy Bear's brimming bowl. While hoping to splat a bite-sized morsel across the breakfast table into Baby Bear's open mouth. Yet, that hope was realistic. Like a pan-galactic potter, poised to throw a lump of clay onto the wheel, the accretor was the master of its craft. It was satisfied with Theia's approach profile, and was sensing the first worldwide stirrings of flowing mantle beneath each body's cracking crust. Deeper down still, it had felt the heavy cores at their hearts, irresistibly falling for each other's attractive charm. Such early signs were reassuringly reminiscent of successful past mergers of a thousand alien worlds. So, as the swiftly sharpening shadow of Theia moved upon the fractured face of its beckoning grave, the accretor used these few remaining moments to make one final forecast of the looming magmatic maelstrom's likely outcome. And the accretor saw that it was good. In the years prior to dispensing its first perturbation pulse, the accretor had considered over 67 sextillion simulated closing paths of Theia and Earth. All but a handful had been summarily discarded, as ultimately failing to deliver the essential conditions required for life. Even the path eventually chosen was about to leave one major, and several minor aspects of the new system's desired motions still unsatisfied. Those targets would just have to wait, for now. Indeed, perhaps the most undesirable characteristic of Earth's current motion would soon be passed on to its new moon, to leave a lunar legacy that would later help to inspire the awe and admiration of future humans. In condensing from the primordial circumstellar debris, the solar system's major planetary orbits had all formed within roughly the same disk, defining what would one day be termed the ecliptic plane. Seen from any major planet, this constrained the Sun and other planets to forever patrol a restricted band of sky, the ecliptic. Beyond the far-flung fate of those future planetesimals born too close to Jupiter, by their highly elliptical orbits, that would not change much. However, the spin axes of several planets had previously been pushed this way and that, from their natural equatorial alignment, perpendicular to the ecliptic plane. Such axial tweaks were mainly due to a mix of their internal magmatic motions, gravitational perturbations from other planets, and off-plane collisions with a myriad impactors. In that context, Earth had actually fared quite well, with its equator currently tilted less than 6 degrees from the ecliptic plane. So, it was along a path, precisely within Earth's equatorial plane, that Theia bore down upon its point of impact. Among sentient species, moments of first contact would long be anticipated as the stuff of dreams, or of nightmares. Of future fellowship between comparable cosmic partners, or the fatal consumption of one, by the overpowering presence of the other. Albeit an interplanetary, rather than interspecies encounter, Theia's first contact with Earth would certainly count among the latter. Yet, the collision of Theia with Earth would barely even register as a noteworthy spectacle on the true scale of cosmic calamities. The last 20 million years or so had probably seen the passing peak of planetary pummeling. A myriad planetesimal cast-offs from the Sun's birth had long since swept up most of its discarded debris, before bequeathing their own bulk, to beefing up one or another of the solar system's bodybuilding finalists. Future phases of heavy bombardment would indeed come to confer cratered character upon the faces of the surviving planets and their moons. But, long before setting its interstellar sail towards the Sun, the accreta had chosen to arrive at this critical phase of the solar system's development. In doing so, it had ensured ready access to the pre-accreted bodies it now needed to do its job, without unduly risking the destruction of its hard-wrought handiwork, in the far future. So, barely a million years after the accreta's arrival from afar, came the moment of cosmically creative contact between Theia and the body into which it would become forever bound. And, to whose cradle it was graciously bearing three geologically generous gifts of new mass, magnetosphere, and moon. Chapter 1.5 Ring Arises. When worlds collide, the mechanical strength of their matter pales into insignificance against the overpowering momentum and energy of their mass. Even had Theia been a body of solid rock, its impact with Earth would hardly have been less self-destructive. These were no colliding cosmic billiard balls, about to bounce benignly off one another, but bulging bags of then still fluid nickel iron core and molten rocky mantle, encased within crispy, cracking crustal coats. As the momentum of Theia's bulk drove it careering into Earth's still fragile crust, its mass began an equally crushing deceleration. Proportional to the square of its rapidly draining velocity, the immense and indestructible kinetic energy of that mass suddenly had to go somewhere, in some form. But, at least partly, as heat. A fraction of that thermal energy would broadcast news of this spectacle across the entire solar system, instantly boiling gigatons of rock into white glowing vapor and sending a blinding flash forth from a rapidly widening ring around the point of impact. A flash immediately followed, in all directions, by a first incandescent installment of molten magma, blasted into orbit from the interiors of both bodies. But, a far larger fraction of Theia's energy had preceded its rapidly disintegrating body, ever deeper into Earth's mantle. An immense thermomechanical shockwave had surged downward and outward from the impact point, almost instantly remelting the fragile crust of Earth into a roiling ring of rock around the rapidly disappearing dome of Theia's remaining hemisphere. A dome that was also visibly distorting as it drove, not only downwards, but also sideways into Earth's yielding bulk. With exquisite precision, the accreta had directed Theia's descent along a curving final approach that had drawn its death shadow across Earth's daylight hemisphere before plunging Theia obliquely into its equator at local sunset. Drawing heavily upon a billion years of moon-making mastership, it had carefully crafted that critical angle of impact to inject Theia's momentum to optimum effect, both west to east, along Earth's equator, and, for now, deep into its interior. Although grateful for the geologic gifts so generously conferred upon it, Earth was suddenly struggling to contain what was fast becoming too much of a good thing. But it would soon have some relief. For as Theia's core crashed into Earth's increasingly well-mixed upper mantle, its sloping shockwave surged ever further sideways and deeper down. Mostly either missing or efficiently reflected by the surface of Earth's molten core, that shockwave had soon passed its greatest depth. It was now speeding towards the thin, but still solid crust, almost a third of the way around the equator. This time, though, rising rapidly upward. Barely had the impact shockwave slammed up into Earth's crustal base from below, than the ripping bulge pushed ahead of Theia's sidelong entry reached the same point. A fallen world's worth of explosive energy could at last get behind 100 quintillion tons of seething, molten mantle, setting the scene for the mightiest and messiest mass ejection of material that planet Earth would ever make. Had the accreta ever been tempted to pass aesthetic judgment upon its own works, it might have considered Theia's impact and slanting burial to have been one of its tidiest to date. True, there were several huge plumes of incandescent impact ejecta heading out along wide, if mostly suborbital arcs, that would bring them crashing back down to Earth. But this merger of minor body into major world had otherwise been commendably well contained. So far, at least. That was good news indeed, for Earth's future prospects, as it implied an efficient injection of much-needed momentum from impactor to impactee. Yet, as the core of what had once been Theia dove deeper into its new host, a sizable fraction of that imparted momentum rebounded back into space. This time around, though, some of that precious momentum-bearing matter would stay up, for good. Seconds later, the ascending shockwave shattered the surface of the Earth, instantly tearing a continent-sized strip of crust into vast magma-coated shreds. Squeezed between the shockwave's direct path and its reflection off the liquid core, 80 billion cubic kilometers of glowing mantle were blasted spaceward, through a gaping breach in Earth's crustal equator, instantly turning its dark side to day. Its velocity boosted west to east by Earth's newly raised rate of rotation, enough shattered crust and seething mantle to build several new moons, rose obliquely along a parabolic ascent path which would soon cast it over 20,000 kilometers, out into space. But its permanent freedom from earthly confinement would be very hard won, indeed. Curving into a crimson fan, as it wrapped itself gracefully around Earth's equatorial sky, the pulverized plume rode its roller coaster path towards two very distinct destinies. Drained of orbital velocity by friction, gas release, and mutual collisions, most of its energized ejector would come crashing back down on the newly enlarged planet just hours later. But that sacrifice would not be in vain, as it returned more much-needed momentum to further raise Earth's rotation rate. Even the looming loss of so much matter from the plume would not actually matter, at all, to the success of the accretor's plan. Almost 19 billion cubic kilometers of mostly former proto-Earth had found itself with enough lateral velocity to miss its home planet, altogether, forever. An amount that would suffice, for now. This job was still far from done, but the first installment of Earth's new axial stabilizer had been duly delivered to its doorstep and unpacked for self-assembly. As a billion bright and radiantly rose-red mountains of molten magma spread themselves around their new eternal path, the half-resurfaced planet below played host to its very own circumplanetary ring. But this ring of roses would never fall down. Chapter 1.6. Red Sky at Night. For the next century or so, barely a tick in geological time, the accretor watched on, as the two actors of accretion under its direction each performed to perfection their own uniquely creative roles. Deep within the Earth, the dense nickel-iron mass that had once marked Theia's heavy heart had soon sunk through the much lighter mantle. Merging both its mass and momentum with Earth's own, it had kick-started the first stirrings of the complex core Coriolis vortices that would ultimately forge a protective magnetosphere around this entire world. Barely 20,000 kilometers above Earth's still molten equator, a far more visually spectacular transformation had taken place. First fashioned into a roiling ring of red glowing rocks, within just a few of the days newly shortened by the impact of Theia, Earth's very own circumplanetary debris disk had then undergone a surprisingly rapid series of mergers, making what Earth could at last proudly proclaim as its new moon. That such a body could be formed by ring matter accretion was down to the efficiency of the impact parameters set up by the accretor. Had the ring been just a few thousand kilometers lower, within around 3 Earth radii of its surface, then any clumping together of its matter would have been overwhelmed by the same gravitational tides that had so deformed Theia on its final fall. Forces, relentlessly determined to rip apart any growing moonlets, might instead have left Earth as the solar system's first, visually alluring, but biologically barren, ringed planet. Yet, a substantial moon had indeed grown from the seed sown into a stable, if somewhat eccentric Earth orbit, by Theia's impact. Those selenic seeds had been forged from the mixed mantles of both bodies, with a hint of errant then core thrown in to give the moon a strong heart. But, as both worlds had originally accreted in the same solar orbit, from much the same mix of chemical compounds and elemental isotopes, the crustal compositions of Earth and Moon would exhibit only subtle differences. A century of cooling had left both surfaces still radiating into space, the thermal energy blasted into them by the accreta-crafted collision. Intense shockwaves had reverberated around Earth for days afterwards, conspiring with the gravitational stresses induced by Theia's fatal approach to remelt much of its crust, the seething surface of which was now being baked beneath a dense mist of silicate vapor and scalded by superheated steam, boiled off what had briefly been the dark waters of its first shallow seas. Meanwhile, Earth's new moon was racing around its orbit with all the eagerness of youth. Clocking almost 4 kilometers per second, it was completing a pole positioning lap of its planetary anchor, roughly every 12 hours, its gravitational pull dragging behind two bulging rock tides, which would only be outpaced by Earth's even more rapid rotation. Beyond its blistering bustle, its sheer visual scale would have mightily impressed any early moon watcher. From Earth's surface, this speeding satellite's crimson-red bulk projected a vast and menacing form upon the sky. A demonic disk, waxing to almost 20 times the width of the Sun. Cast from an orbit inclined only a few degrees to the ecliptic plane, the immense Selenic shadow was repeatedly plunging a sizable area of Earth's daytime hemisphere deep into the darkness of a total solar eclipse on almost every pass. Matched only in fiery foreboding from its far side, as the moon's molten surface cast the hellish hue of a red sky at night. The first phase of the accreta's creative plan may have been over, but its work was still far from finished. Theia's equatorial plane approach had conferred Earth's 6-degree inclination upon the moon's new orbit. Fortunately, such a modest lunar orbital slant would, ultimately, suffice for the efficient far-future stabilization of Earth's axial tilt. To which, however, the accreta would next turn its attention. After a billion years of manic moon-making, the accreta had already left a trail of 1,000 and more potentially habitable planet moon systems in its pan-galactic wake. Yet, it was still far too soon for it to have seen much in the way of biological bounty from its handiwork. Such wonders would rarely evolve beyond primitive single-celled organisms within a few billion years of their habitat's birth. Only with the volcanic and cometary delivery of ocean depths, growing geologic stability and higher energy atmospheric chemistry would advanced life then thrive. It could easily have considered its task already well done for this system too. But, beyond axially stabilizing each new home for that prospective life, the accreta's own creators had programmed in two other target planetary parameters that would also help to progress its ultimate purpose. Of those, one was deemed absolutely essential to the long-term evolution of higher life. The other, if at all achievable, was a nice-to-have that might well, someday, help to lure future intelligence above the boundaries of its birth cradle and out into the beckoning blackness of boundless space beyond. For almost 80 million years prior to their departure, the entities who would spawn the accreta had surveyed, studied, and sampled the entire pan-galactic panoply of biological species. Although their own collective consciousness had long since forged far beyond the bounds of biology, they knew that the very fragility of biochemical life was by far the best guarantee of its ultimate transformation to their form. For only in the wake of innumerable extinctions could life explore all the possible paths to the perfection which only they had yet achieved. That galactic survey had uncovered a multitude of life forms, reflecting the extreme diversity of planetary habitats within which each had evolved. Almost all advanced evolution had required the universal solvent of life, liquid water, aside accessible sources of stellar or geochemical energy, preferably protected by a magnetospheric shield and an axially stabilizing moon, akin to those the accreta was so kindly conferring upon Earth. One other characteristic of a planet's spin axis had also been found to correlate strongly with evolutionary success. The heartbeats of higher life cycles would so often be stronger when synchronized to the steady rhythm of their planet's orbit around its star by the passage of seasons. Such life clocking seasons demanded a decent tilt of a planet's equator relative to its ecliptic plane. Not so far as to drive dangerous annual extremes of heat and cold, but rather more than the 6 degrees the Earth currently enjoyed. So, endowing Earth with a set of stable seasons, suited to the annual beat of biological rebirth, would be the primary objective of the accretor's next move. In the process, it would take aim at that other, nice-to-have target. However, to sadly mix sporting metaphors, hitting both bullseyes with the same dart would be the planetary equivalent of bouncing a curving cue ball around a billiard table and pocketing all the colors in one go. That feat simply might not be physically possible in this case. But the accretor was, once more, about to carefully uncase its cosmic cue stick and take its very best shot. Chapter 1.7. High Hyperion. Only as the orbital dynamics of the new Earth-Moon system settled down, could the accretor consider its next move. The undoubted success of its bid to dedicate Theia's fall to the cause of Earth's fertility had relied on its intimate knowledge of the initial conditions at the outset. That hope could so easily have been dashed by even the smallest of errors in sensing the starting position and motion of either body, the drag forces acting upon them due to circumstellar gas, dust and solar wind, or the gravitational pull of the Sun and other planets. But at least, then, the accretor had been able to make its measurements, at its leisure, over the previous million years. Not only would there now be an extra degree of difficulty to the dance, but time was also of the essence. There were dynamic constraints upon the next phase that could put total success beyond the accretor's reach if it waited too long. For a key player in the next event, just would not stay put. The new moon was on the move. Unlike the solar system's handful of retrograde moons, orbiting in the opposite direction to their planet's spin, Earth's prograde moon would never be in any danger of falling back down upon its planet. Indeed, quite the opposite. The immense tidal bulges the moon was dragging around the Earth took time to rise and fall, so would be twisted ahead of the Earth-Moon line by Earth's even more rapid rotation in the same direction. The nearer bulge's greater gravitational attraction towards the moon was acting as a small but significant brake on Earth's spin rate. And, as Earth's rotation slowed, it was losing angular momentum. Conservation of momentum would be the primary physical principle behind the first rocket-propelled, off-world ventures of most emergent species. Linear momentum, mass times velocity, blasted behind a rocket, would always match the momentum thrust ahead. Similarly, the angular momentum of the rotating Earth-Moon system would also be conserved. So, as Earth's angular momentum slowly drained, that of the Moon would be boosted. Unable to change its mass, nor to increase its velocity, the Moon could only express its growing angular momentum through an enlarged orbit. It simply had no option other than to start moving away from Earth. Setting itself onto the ever more circular, but outwardly spiraling path it would pursue for the next several billion years. The orbital evolution of the accretor's planet Moon creation severely constrained the time available to execute the second phase of its plan. So, barely had the last boulders of blasted rock embedded their mass within the Moon, than the accretor set about preparing its next perturbations. The once steady dominance of distant Theia's light in every pre-dawn sky had finally fallen to the ferocious, if fickle, red glare of the Moon. But such had been the circumsolar bounty of dusty debris from which Earth and Theia had formed, that ample had been left over for another beacon. One which the maternal gravity of Earth had coaxed, gently but firmly, into its other cradle of co-orbital stability. The fifth point of Lagrange. Of Hyperion, we are told that he was the first to understand, by diligent attention and observation, the movement of both the Sun and the Moon and the other stars, and the seasons as well, in that they are caused by these bodies, and to make these facts known to others, and that, for this reason, he was called the father of these bodies, since he had begotten, so to speak, the speculation about them and their nature. Diodorus Siculus, 567-1. Counterpoising Theia, some 60 degrees behind Earth along its orbit, Hyperion had long held the high ground of the heavens' daily march across the sky. Always setting 1/6 of a day after the Sun, the High One had bathed Earth's darkening hemisphere in a stream of reflected sun rays throughout the hours of evening sky beyond every dusk. From its high heavenly watchpost, Hyperion had observed its Mother Earth's first century-long embrace of the new moon so selflessly created by the sacrifice of its sister. So, as the accreta ran yet another 70 sextillion precision simulations, it would soon be, to Theia's smaller sibling, that would fittingly fall the honor of completing its plan. For not only would Hyperion one day sacrifice itself to one final touch of the moon, it would also add a vital pinch of seasoning to Earth's recipe for future life. Although significantly less massive than its big sister, Hyperion's bulk still promised another benign boost of the metallic core and silicate mantle that Theia had donated, in death, to Earth. Those would soon supplement their respective earthly domains, firmly pushing its core dynamics and gas-gripping mass well into the safe zones for such life-sustaining qualities. Yet, welcome as they would be, material gains were not the first priority of the accreta's next perturbations, nor even, for that matter, the second. The course set by the accreta for Theia's voyage from L4 to Earth had never cast it far from the ecliptic plane. Only for its final approach had an off-plane component been induced to align its descent along Earth's equator. But, with the moon now firmly established in that gently tilted orbit, a more radical realignment of Earth's own axis could be attempted. And that would demand a lot more leverage. So began a long series of subtle tugs on Hyperion, each one timed to resonate with and incrementally accentuate its orbital inclination relative to Earth's. Only when fully satisfied with its off-plane orbital options did the accreta finally see fit to administer the last, fateful pulse of gravitational grapple power in its program for this planetary system. When, with one gigantic jolt, it wrenched Hyperion forever from L5, launching it onto a long, lonely and one-way drift into the grasp of Gaia. 15 months later, it was Hyperion's own turn to sweep its sharpening shadow over the still fiery sunward face of the planet it had for so long been faithfully following from afar. But, where Theia had dug deep upon arrival, its smaller sibling would settle for a swifter and far more superficial swipe at its target. Or, at least, at its first target. This circumstellar stalker was about to strike a glancing blow upon its victim. It was running in to deliver a hit-and-run assault that would leave Earth's spin axis forever askew. Although, actually, in a good way. By increasing the tilt of Hyperion's orbit away from the ecliptic plane, before launching it earthward, the accreta had set up a rather different end path for its second impactor. Theia's deep plunge along Earth's equator had been designed both to speed up its rotation and to throw a decent mass of moon matter skyward. Hyperion's descent to doom, though, would display a sizable north-south velocity component designed to endow upon Earth just a little more rotational speed and a lot more axial tilt. The efficient delivery of that tilt would be akin to tipping a spinning top, best performed by a deft downward touch at its outermost edge. So, the coming assault would constitute a minimally invasive, surgical strike, driving Hyperion just deep enough below Earth's crust to dump its core and a little more than half of its own mantle, leaving a huge slice of its former body free for what really was the accreta's second target. On the day, the accreta's profoundly precise predictions were subjected to the usual chaotic convolutions of physical reality. The mixing of rocky melts and metals, as mantles, crusts and cores collided, would often confound even the galaxy's most comprehensive simulations. But the accreta was no newbie to these numerical games. And it had long since come to accept the corruption of its clinically clean aspirations by the greater realism of its expectations. As if grinding grit into an already gaping wound, Hyperion hit Earth only around 3,000 kilometers northwest of Theia's original impact point. that coincidence of collision points, a century apart, whilst yet again melting almost half of Earth's mantle, down to the core, actually spared a tiny region of original crust, on the far side. Had the combined energy of both Theia and Hyperion been dumped in one go, then this battered body would now be bathed in the red incandescence of a global magma ocean. Although significantly less energetic than Theia's fall, Hyperion's half-a-body blow still imparted another huge shockwave into Earth's mantle. More importantly, the large north-to-south component of its impact velocity had forever altered the rotational dynamics of the entire planet. Over the subsequent years required for its ringing global deformations to subside, Earth's equatorial inclination swung around erratically, before slowly settling from its once 6-degree tilt off the solar system's plane to an oscillating obliquity of the ecliptic, exceeding 20 degrees. The breaking of that telltale formative bond between Earth's original axial tilt and the Moon's orbital plane would puzzle human scientists pondering the origin of their planet-Moon pair. But, as the natural wobbles of Earth's newly tilted spin axis subsided, its poles would commence their respective annual nods towards and away from the heat of the Sun, powering the yearly rhythm that would one day regulate the reproductive tick of higher life forms to the stable, cyclic certainty of the seasons. Its highest priority aim achieved, the accreta could do little more than wait to see if its long shot at a second target was anywhere near the mark. Yet, it knew it would never be a nearby witness to the ultimate culmination of that attempt, destined to unfold many millions of years hence. By then, the accreta would be long gone from this system, for it was already well advanced in the selection of the next astral afterbirth to attract its attention. But it could, at least, witness the birth of the bizarre finale of its plan for this young star's best hope of bringing forth intelligent life. Hyperion's glancing impact had done a surprisingly neat job of shearing away almost half of its mantle mass to continue onwards and upwards from Earth. Its rocky remains had been left with just enough relative velocity to send its bisected bulk on a tangential ascent away from the seething maelstrom caused by its better half below. That ascent had left it on a highly elongated orbit, reaching apogee, its furthest point from Earth, some 19,000 kilometers away. Velocity spread within Hyperion's dizzily spinning sheared and shattered remaining hemisphere would bring most of it crashing back down upon the planet days later. Yet a huge mass would survive to join the product of Theia's demise in stable orbit, devoid of close cosmic company. Little more than a century ago, Earth could now boast not one, but two new moons. Within weeks, the rocky remains of Hyperion had reformed into a loosely spherical body on a promising intercept path, leaving the accreta to reassess, with rising hope, its chance of hitting that nice-to-have target. And the accreta saw that it was good. Even so, its experience of many similar scenarios had left the accreta uncertain as to the eventual outcome of the interplay it had initiated. Its control of Hyperion's approach had been ultra-precise, but its post-impact predictions could only be coarse. By the time things came to a head, such devilish details could drift the accreta's design from dream to disaster. Earth's new dual-moon system had been created at the call of the accreta. In pulling Theia and Hyperion from their birth sites before they reached orbital instability, it had cleared away the two greatest risks to future life on Earth. But the accreta would yet live up to its name, one more time, as it persistently pursued the last planetary parameter needed for perfection. By throwing material from an earthly equator tilted 6 degrees to the ecliptic, it had endowed both the lunar orbital plane and equator with that same inclination. That was fine for the Moon's roles of stabilizing Earth's own newly jolted axial tilt and guarding the steady cycling of earthly seasons over geologic and evolutionary time. So, what more could the accreta hope to achieve by casting half of Hyperion onto this same path? Well, it had given Hyperion's approach path a substantial off-plane component, mainly to push Earth's equatorial tilt further away from the ecliptic plane, so as to strengthen those seasons. But it had also sought to apply one more throw of the dice, or, more fittingly, spin of the roulette wheel, to the tilt of the moon's equator. With the intention, this time, of reducing that tilt. So, why on the moon would it want to do that? The accretor had already fulfilled its brief of creating another potentially habitable world, from which life could spring forth. Yet, its own creators had chosen this parting gift to the galaxy in grateful celebration of their species' good fortune, spotted soon after its scientific emergence. For not only had their birth planet been endowed with the mass, magnetosphere and major moon needed to enable their evolution, but that moon's equator had also been aligned within a degree of their star's ecliptic plane. That fact had, of course, meant nothing at all to their species throughout its natural evolution and early nurturing of scientific knowledge. Only as they stood to stare up at their night sky in wonder, from the technological threshold of interplanetary exploration, had an important implication of their moon's low inclination been recognized, to ever-rising anticipation. Its equator lay virtually upon the ecliptic plane, so its poles were perpendicular to that plane, which not only kept the powering light of their star in perpetual proximity to its polar horizons, but it also draped the inner realms of its deeper polar craters in equally perpetual darkness. Although larger than Earth's moon would ever be, theirs too had still lacked sufficient mass to retain an appreciable atmosphere. Most of the water wetting its airless surface from within, or dumped by cometary impacts from afar, had been boiled and blown away by the wild winds of their powerful star. Only upon the dark and ultra-frigid floors of its polar craters had vast volumes of water survived, in the hardy form of ice. Driven by much the same early scientific insight as many later species, the discovery of water ice at the poles of their moon had spurred the first long-term settlements beyond the bounds of their birth world. The melting and hydrolysis of polar crater ice had been energized by the nearby perpetual light of their horizon-hugging star, sourcing water and fuel to sustain their bodies and power their spacecraft. Those first polar moon bases had launched them onto the interplanetary exploration of their neighborhood, followed by their interstellar spread across much of the galaxy as their biological bodies intellectually evolved into far more mobile machines. Even as the worlds of their youth succumbed to the death throes of their brightly burning but relatively short-lived star, none would forget how the early survival of their ancient species had been assured, in part, by that unlikely alignment of their moon's equator along the ecliptic plane of their planetary system. So when, over 82 million future Earth years later, the time and inspiration came to depart their birth galaxy, they had instilled that apparently incidental target inclination into the ultra-intelligent intent of the mighty machine created in their own image. Only after the accretor had been cast towards its first stellar birth, though, did a far-sighted few of the near-infinite facets of their collective consciousness pause to ponder upon one very profound proposition. That they, too, might once have been the blessed but unsuspecting beneficiaries of some ancient, alien ancestor of the Moon Maker. Chapter 1.8. Moon of the Moon. The accretor could never know, for certain, whether Earth's new moon would ever find itself enticing future intelligence out to its icy, polar promise. The desired leveling of its equatorial plane depended upon the chance outcome of the encounter looming just a few years after Hyperion's self-shearing swipe at Earth. But the accretor already knew that the game was, at least, on. Hyperion's hemispherical remains had been launched into a highly elongated orbit, one which reached out almost to the slowly circularizing path of the far more massive moon. Even with its vertical excursions well above and below the plane of the moon's orbit, some sort of interaction between the two was inevitable. Such had been the accretor's plan. It had aimed and timed Hyperion's earthward approach to avoid any danger of direct impact between the twin moons now entwining their orbits. That would have risked far too much unpredictable damage to what was the prized trophy of its primary mission, with little hope of gainful benefit. Moon, and moon, would indeed kiss face to face, one day, albeit hopefully, in a rather less directly destructive embrace. But only after a long and intimate introduction to each other, upon the orbital dance floor. Most of the 70 sextillion simulations of Hyperion's possible paths to destruction had actually explored its motion after its impact with Earth. The accretor could not control the precise dynamics of the shearing process. But it had been able to predict where virtually every feasible outcome would send Earth's second moon, for years to come. So it had chosen the approach path with the greatest number of desirable end points. One of which was finally about to emerge. The gravitational capture of one astronomical body by another would one day be proposed as the means by which Earth had acquired its own moon. Although, at first, outwardly attractive, this idea would soon be rejected as requiring far too great a coincidence of relative path and velocity for earthly gravity to grasp such a large body purely in passing. That rejection would be confirmed when mankind's first samples of the moon's surface showed how similar its chemical and isotopic composition was to that of Earth's mantle. Yet, the accretor's prodigious predictive powers had set the otherwise unlikely conditions by which not Earth, but its moon, would actually come to capture a companion all of its very own. Settled into a barely spherical shape, after almost 2 years in its elongated orbit, the shattered moonlet once again approached its highest point above Earth. Earlier visits to this lonely spot had found it firmly beyond the gravitational grasp of a moon, busily going about its orbit elsewhere. But this apogee would see it soaring to within a few thousand kilometers of its earthly orbital companion. Seen from above the northern side of the ecliptic plane, Earth's new satellites were both spinning and orbiting in an anti-clockwise direction. Along with, for that matter, the rotation of the Sun and the axial spins and solar orbits of every major planet. That rotational preference reflected the original angular momentum trapped within the collapsing interstellar cloud from which the Sun and its entire planetary system had formed. It was a preference not likely to be denied. The grace to go with the flow had long given the planets and moons of the galaxy and beyond the greatest chance of being around over geological time. Exceptions to that natural rotational orientation often indicated either the past incidence of, or a future invitation to, cosmic calamity. To which, the accretor looked ahead, with some satisfaction, as it hailed the steady convergence of its last-born moon's course and velocity, with the orbit of its older sibling, stalking it just a few thousand kilometers behind. The relative arrival order of both bodies at this point had been critical. For as the moonlet felt the gravitational tug of the moon grow to match that of the more distant Earth, its momentum carried it beyond its original apogee into a clockwise curve around the moon that would soon close itself into a surprisingly circular orbit. Its path was now in the opposite, retrograde direction to the spin of the moon, a fact designed to make a fundamental difference to its ultimate orbital fate. Contrary to the moon's prograde path around the Earth, this rotational reverse direction would drain angular momentum from the orbiting object, forcing it to descend ever closer to the body around which it circled. Millions of years hence, the doomed moonlet would first shatter under gravitationally induced tidal stresses and then splatter its matter onto the surface of the moon below. In doing so, its retrograde momentum would slow the moon's own rotation, further boosting a trend that would eventually leave the same lucky lunar face forever tidally locked in admiration of Earth's slowly blooming blue beauty. At the same time, its off-plane momentum would deliver a jolting prod at the moon's axial tilt, attempting another tip of the spinning top, which might, or might not, cast both perpetual darkness and the promise of future icy bounty into its deeper polar craters. It was perhaps fitting that this final phase of the accretor's plan so uncannily conveyed the dynamics of a cosmic casino. It had no way to predict, this far in advance, precisely when, or where, the decaying orbit of its recently released rolling ball would spiral into, and onto, the contra-rotating wheel at its center. So, the accretor had bravely, but with hope, placed its gambling chips firmly upon the table. It could now only calmly contemplate what it could no longer wait to witness. Its far future bet on the outcome of this half a billion year spin of the roulette wheel. From its high station at L5, through its shearing delivery of seasonal tilt, the heritage of Hyperion had arrived in orbit around the object born in the violent death throes of Theia. Its body had been sacrificed to the greater cause of fostering future life in this solar system. But the name of Hyperion would, someday, return, to be celebrated by that life, as an outer satellite of mighty Saturn. This strange satellite of a satellite just might, one distant day, deliver a single, supposedly natural body, able to tempt future evolved intelligence from its earthly cradle, with the promise of accessible polar ice. Until then, it would owe its ultimately doomed existence to the daring of the accretor. In both semantic senses, it was the moon of the moon that the moon maker made. Chapter 1.9. Seeds of Genesis. Over the billion-year course of its cosmic mission, the accretor had already created the conditions for potential life upon a myriad new worlds. Its own creators had known the basic components of life were abundant across the galaxy. Chemical elements created both by fusion, within, and the ultraviolet death, of, stellar cores, had long been strewn, far across interstellar space, in vast, primordial clouds. Between, upon and inside the dusty grains of which, those elements had been forged into the fundamental chemical compounds of life, in the fiery light of nearby stars. Sooner or later, some of those compounds would seed the surfaces of planetary systems, also formed from the debris of long-past stellar detonations. Given suitably benign conditions, such pre-biological substances would eventually spark reproductive rhythms, able to render their form into future generations of early life. Upon a rare few of those worlds, the evolutionary enablers of time, stability, and biochemical energy would ultimately breach the biological bridge from single-celled bacteria to multi-celled beasts, even perhaps bearing sentient intelligence beyond. The accretor's creators had also come to realize their own incredibly good fortune. Their species had barely evolved emergent intelligence before their bright but fast-burning stellar host had started running dangerously low on fuel for fusion and set upon its own, ever more dramatic demise. Scientific and technological enlightenment had dawned, only just in time to enable their survival, as that star fitfully shed a first shell of matter, to briefly dampen down its deepening internal turmoil. A threatened extinction, which had spurred their pan-galactic search for new homes. That early history of their species had ultimately driven the accretor's innate conviction to deliver not only the conditions for life, but also the seeds of life. It was not willing to entrust the biological exploitation of its efforts entirely to the long-chained chance coincidences of mostly carbon-based chemistry. The accretor, alone, could cast certainty over future fortune upon its cosmic creations. For its final call, upon completing yet another habitable world, would always be to let there be life. The accretor knew that it would be long gone and far distant before the new Earth could stand any chance at all of nurturing life of its own. Tens of millions of years would yet pass before anything like a stable crust could cool above the ocean of openly molten mantle that now covered most of the planet. Even then, the outgassing of a substantial atmosphere would be needed to sustain the surface stability and liquid flow of the water already steaming from its interior or yet to be delivered by comets. Life would just have to wait until this awakening world's weather could rain its universal solvent into oceans, seas, lakes and rivers. So, activation of the two wondrous devices the accretor was preparing would take a half-billion-year rain check. Which meant, it would have to seek somewhere suitably stable and safe to store them in the meantime. The accretor needed to find two very special locations, one for each device, with specific and somewhat unusual characteristics. Both would have to remain inherently stable over immense timescales, whilst staying well within seeding distance of the Earth. Furthermore, each would need to offer their sole occupant at least a fighting chance of survival over the ages of interplanetary bombardment yet to come. Simply placing its precious new protégés upon the surface of the Earth itself was out of the question. Even after its crust had cooled, the endless global stirrings of plate tectonics would leave virtually no place untouched by deep geologic turmoil. Nor would Earth's new moon offer a safe haven, given the impending descent to destruction of its own satellite. The devices also had to keep clear of the complex and constantly shifting gravitational gradients permeating the space within the Earth, Moon, Moon system. There would be no long-term safety in orbit around anybody here. But the accreta had, of course, just evicted two orbital tenants from prime locations, which could indeed serve its purpose. So, it would entrust its primary and backup devices to two well-separated regions of space at a safe and stable distance from Earth. It would populate the paired peaks of gravitational potential, which had, until recently, harbored the seeds of Earth's geological transformation. The twin layers of Lagrange, which, alone, could offer long-term safety to the future bringers of Earth's biological transformation. To its seeds of Genesis. Easing its 2-million-ton resting mass outward from its orbit, midway between Venus and Earth, the accreta rose towards the same now lonely Lagrangian lair from which it had gravitationally seduced Theia just centuries ago. However, it would not leave its precious cargo precisely at L4, but in a long, lazy orbit around it. For there was still ample chance of debris aggregation within this region over the coming story of the solar system. And these were certainly not seeds to appreciate being buried. As it neared the release point for its first device drop, the accreta had one final, but fundamentally life-changing decision to make. In their survey of the galaxy's myriad lifeforms, its creators had found surprisingly few basic biological mechanisms by which evolution could achieve the best balance between two conflicting needs. On the one hand, the advantages of evolution could only accumulate across generations via a stable and accurate genetic copying process. On the other, the progress of evolution, perversely, demanded imperfection in that very same process, so as to drive exploration of the ever-changing pitfalls and possibilities of life's paths. The optimum genetic error rate to balance accumulated advantage against agile adaptation was arguably the single most critical factor in any evolutionary system's success. The accreta would delegate some decisions regarding which genetic bounty would someday seed Earth to the intelligence and database bound within each of its devices. But it, alone, wore responsibility for the choice of basic biochemistry upon which this planetary system would build over the next several billion years. A decision dependent upon both the nature of its star and where its circumgalactic orbital path would likely take it. Each orbit of the Sun and its planets around the center of the galaxy would take well in excess of 200 million years, during which time the Sun, along with most stars, would both drift into and out of the galaxy's denser spiral arms and oscillate above and below the plane of its disk, either of which would modulate Earth's exposure to a major driver of genetic variation over evolutionary time: the mighty cosmic rays. These immensely energetic particles could be cast clear across the cosmos by the cataclysmic collision of collapsed stellar cores or the merging of massive black holes. Accelerated virtually to light speed, many would traverse intergalactic space in what, to them, would seem mere milliseconds of dilated time. Sometimes, to then dump their colossal kinetic energy into crashing cascades of secondary particles down from the upper atmospheres of any planets in their path. Even, if rarely, to find themselves ripping through the genetic code of some unlucky lifeform. Only the supreme predictive power of the accreta, itself, could hope to gauge the exposure to or protection from such particles that the Sun's future galactic path would offer over giga-years to come. That level would define which fundamental biochemistry best balanced biological stability against sensitivity to damage in the face of future cosmic ray barrages. allowing Earth to remain within the genetic Goldilocks zone that would, with luck, drive its budding life to evolutionary success. So, firmly focused upon the Sun, the accretor once again reset and reran its 2 trillion body, 10 billion year simulation of the entire galaxy. By this time, it really should have known better, but the accretor never ceased to be surprised by its own predictions of the future galactic paths of the stars it had visited, even when they had been born in the same region of space. The Sun had been just the latest stellar stopover on its little local tour of a huge, collapsing cloud of interstellar gas and dust, from which several other solar siblings would yet burst into life. Its next stellar target, born less than 100 light-years away, harbored high hopes of hosting life on what would become its 3 habitable planets, upon which the accretor had chosen to confer a truly spectacular orbital configuration. It was possible that the galactic orbit of its siblings would match the Sun's into the far future. There were, indeed, many sizable clusters of stars that felt gravitationally bound to keep each other company on their travels. Further afield, a huge halo of immense globular clusters orbited, often well away from the galactic plane, some binding upwards of 1 million stars into a sparkling, spherical spectacle, just a few light years across. But most simulations for its previous star, still only 50 light years away, had predicted a dramatically divergent path over the course of its life. That star's galactic journey would expose its 2 newly habitable planets to considerably greater cosmic ray flux than that being forecast for the Sun, which had led to a far more robust choice of its basic biology than would soon be selected for the seeding of Earth. Billions of years hence, one of the greatest triumphs of future human science would be its unraveling of the organic strands which wove the sterile stuff of chemistry into the fertile fabric of life. As that knowledge grew broader and deeper, it would even explore some of the same biochemical alternatives now being carefully considered, but all firmly dismissed by the accretor as it pondered that fateful decision. Under different predictive conditions, some of those options, notably the so-called xenonucleic acids, XNAs, might even have looked a little more attractive to the accretor. Candidates such as anhydrohexyl nucleic acid, HNA, and threose nucleic acid, TNA, would be found to possess at least some of the qualities which could confer stable, but steady, long-term evolution upon earthly life. But it would be upon 2 other, related, nucleic acids that the accretor would place the burden of bearing this planet's biological evolution forward into the future. Of those, the more primitive, single-stranded ribonucleic acid, RNA, would be cast to play a range of vital roles in the dramatic propagation of that life. Roles directed largely at the behest of its double helical, gene-coding counterpart, deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. Its decision made, the accretor could supply its first seed with the ultra-stable, crystalline forms of the basic elements of life. Ingredients from which this device would, one distant day, print self-sustaining samples of the complex biochemical compounds needed to launch evolution, along with fully formed examples of the primitive archaea that would come to characterize the most ancient of earthly biota. All of which could be cast onto any of many low-energy orbits destined to reach their, by that day hopefully hospitable homeworld, within just a few months. Even then, the future success of this multi-million-year mission could not be left to the whims of fortune. There was still a small chance that some wandering fragment of this system's formation could yet destroy a single device. So, soon after releasing the first of Earth's 2 seeds of Genesis into a gentle orbit around L4, the accretor set forth upon one final lap of the Sun. Once more, going with the flow, the long way round, to L5. This second seed would be configured, primarily, as a backup to its sibling at L4. It would, though, also be provisioned with a biological plan B, as even the accretor's simulations could not eliminate the possibility of a far future encounter between the Sun and an errant star that could cast this stellar system onto an entirely new and unpredicted path, for which some other genetic mechanism might then become optimal. A call to which the B seed would respond, with a long series of sample organisms chosen from its comprehensively pan-galactic genetic treasure chest. The release of that second seed left the accretor fully confident that it had created yet another world which might, ultimately, conceive beings able to ponder their own origin. Such had been the task assigned to it, so long ago, by its own ever more distant creators. Towards whom it turned, to transmit another in a long line, of once-in-a-million-year messages. The accretor knew full well that, by the time their rapidly receding receivers registered its red-shifted report, the potential for life on this world would already have been thoroughly tried and tested. There was now little more it could do for this planetary system. It was already planning its path to the next star to have flared into fusion from this same, immense, molecular cloud. But it would not leave before making a first, and last, farewell visit to the worlds it had so fundamentally reformed. Eager to perform a sign-off inspection of its mega-year handiwork, the accretor slid its 2-megaton mass into a once-around open orbit, high above the night side of an Earth still bathed in the red-tinted glow of its full moon's sunlit face. There to savor the sheer sensational beauty of the cosmic scene created at its own command. For all the ever-darkening majesty of the deepening crust coating both bodies, it was from the ever-shifting streams of light that the accretor always drew the greatest satisfaction on these occasions. The glow of their radiant heat would subside over millennia to come, but any future life on Earth would behold two stable sources of illumination: the directly life-fueling fusion fire of its sun, and the cool, cyclically reflected serenity of its moon. The greater light, to rule the day, the lesser light, to rule the night. Swinging slowly towards the sunward side of its orbit, the accretor was already stirring space-curving forces deep within its form. It would soon again glean gravitons from the higher dimensions into which its existence was so enigmatically embedded. But it would not risk any direct exposure of Earth's delicately entwined twin satellites to such immense gravitational grasp. So, only as it crossed the Sun-Earth line, opposite to, and hidden from the Moon, did the accretor's perturbation pulse rip an almighty rupture through the fabric of interstellar spacetime. As, for just a few fleeting moments, the first and final ethereal shadow of the Moon Maker itself moved upon the face of the Earth. Settled safely into orbit around their Lagrangian lairs, the twin guardians of Genesis had set upon what would become a many-million-year test of patience, biding their time until they could, some distant day, cast upon the Earth the fruit whose seed is in itself. By the grace of the accretor, those fragile seeds would fall upon a planet newly awash with the aqueous solvent of life, rained from an atmosphere firmly grasped by gravity and protected from solar excess by an ever-strengthening magnetosphere. They would be spawning life that could evolve to the steady tick of seasons, stabilized by the calming gravitational call of its sizable moon. One which might even, some fateful day, entice intelligence out to its polar crater rims with the offer of icy sustenance and the energy of eternal light. The accretor had achieved everything asked of it by its own creators in preparing this world for any foreseeable challenges far into its future. Yet, its predictive powers were ultimately limited. For no cosmic crystal gazer could preconceive the darkly dire and calamitous challenges from beyond this galaxy that would curse all of its creations 4 billion years hence. So, suddenly, falling at 400 Earth G towards its next stellar birth, the accretor cast one last look back upon its latest worldly works. Ascending into its self-excavated space-time crevasse, rising above the northern plain of the young sun's planets, it beheld the long-labored layout of its culminated plan, spread out, in eternal glory, below. And the accretor saw everything that it had made. And behold, it was very good. You finally made it, hopefully in one mental piece, through these first 40 pages of Earth and Moon-making mayhem. That's more than the proto-Earth itself managed, so, well done. You are now psychologically prepared to press ahead with pursuing the first novel in the Halion Pentalogy, through into, relatively, recent times. However, should you choose to go forward, no respite will be offered, in growing the grand galactic vista of the Halion Eon adventure. So, a brief synopsis of this 10-billion-year sci-fi epic's opening story is presented shortly. This first novel joins those later in the Halion series, in seeking to stretch our perception of sometimes speculative, but, hopefully, plausible scientific and technological principles. The aim is to inspire your imagination into casting supposedly established historic, mythological, and theological facts in an entirely new, but still logical light. And, who knows? Maybe your own ability to assimilate the concepts concealed within its pages may help to mark mankind's mental readiness for emergence into the greater galactic family of hadronic life entities. Synopsis. Halion Eon launches at the solar system's birth with the ongoing quest of the Accreta to create a myriad habitable planets across this galaxy. From its Moon Maker mission emerges an axially calming companion for the once solitary world, someday to be hailed as Earth. 4 billion years on, 13 deathly dark waves of pan-galactic mass extinction are inflicted by a black beast beyond the galactic bounds. The fight for life and revenge rallies at the end of Earth's last, ever, ice age, as two mighty cosmic cubes arrive to set mankind up for assisted self-protection from imminent demise in the 14th existential apocalypse. While the Venus Cube commences the preparation of its planetary host to wreak revenge upon the galactic scourge, the Earth Cube sets to soothing the magnetospheric instability potentially threatening life on this planet. Its 8 seed cube progeny then coax the first steps of humanity towards ultimate emergence into the pan-galactic family of hadronic life entities. The Nile seed cube creates a cadre of humans transfigured into eons while enthusing and enabling the minds of mankind to embark upon a first, foundational frenzy of megalithic monument making. Projected from the Giza Plateau, above the subterranean Temple of Thoth, an awesome tour of worldly wonders in the solar system sparks our innate curiosity for scientific truth. The event builds to an interstellar voyage, out to a bizarre but breathtakingly beautiful, triplanetary spectacle, born of the Accreta's cosmic creativity. Three worlds that orbit both their star and each other. Upon the vernal fields of Elysium 6 Green, steeped in stellar eclipse, humans first step forward to face, in fear, hauntingly pallid, yet profoundly black-eyed, Kars. These immortal entities convey the quantum-entangled consciousness, accrued karma, and Akashic records of all incarnate souls as they cruise the cosmos in cubically coalesced, unified fractal octets from the vast Kar city hushedly hailed as she who shelters the dead. Their minds now attuned to astronomical cycles, humans are next readied for a profound lifestyle shift, from hunter-gatherers to harvest-gatherers, as they meet for another mind-stretching session in the Temple of Ti, at the sacred site someday to be dubbed Göbekli Tepe. From where, centuries later, the mouthless mentor Kars set mankind a constructive challenge it must not fail, even as they declare the Temple of Ti taboo. Interred deep underground by seismic shock, the Nile Cube plans the rise of mankind to its do or die challenge. A quest long to be led by the Eon Life Transition Agency, ALTA, as Eon Thoth and Archean Metatron finally join forces during the high heavenly spectacle of Aurorion. That was the first chapter and synopsis of Halion Eon by Dave Norman. This first novel of the Halion Pentalogy is available in both printed and ebook formats via the links from halion.com. PDF and audio versions of the first chapters of this and later novels in this series will be linked as they become available. Search Halion Eon on YouTube for other background and samples from the series. Or follow on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Halion Eon to receive news and related information. Thank you very much for listening.